MacCast, Monday, December 12th, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I want to say thank you to all of you who have emailed in to me to give me feedback about what I asked you about at the top of the last MacCast, which was, you know, I'm always confused about how to open up shows, and I wanted to get some feedback. Do you like the sort of banter thing? Do you like just jumping right into it? I have been kind of doing this thing where I quickly summarize the stories that we're going to be covering during the week, and I kind of think I want to shorten that because I don't want to give away too much of the show. So I was curious about what to do, and you gave me some excellent feedback. I received a lot of email, and pretty much the consensus was, with a few outliers, that we just keep doing what we've been doing. So I think that's what I'm going to stick with. Not a lot of banter, but a little stuff at the top of the show just to kind of introduce things and get us all comfortable and ready for what's to come next, but not too much personal stuff. I mean, maybe an odd little thing here and there. If there's something I think is relevant going on, I will share that with you. So I think that's the way to go, and it's been working so far. So yeah, really, why change things? I don't know what I was thinking. Anyway, we've got a great show for you this week. Lots of stuff to talk about. Apple Watch sales in question. We've got fixes and things related to the new MacBook Pros. Lots of stuff going on there, as you might imagine. More updates on what might possibly be happening for the iPhone in 2017. Apple's got some software updates out, including stuff for the Apple TV, Apple Watch, and iOS. Some updates on Apple Pay, some stuff happening with Foxconn, Apple's main iPhone supplier, and a little bit of international news, along with some updates to some of the stories we had been covering last time. And then we've got great feedback from you, updates on touch disease, experiences I asked you to share on the battery replacement program. I have my own to share with you, including some thoughts on something that I had a chance to try out at the Apple Store. Some changes to the Apple Music program and iTunes Match that you probably want to know about. And we're going to discuss ports, and ports specifically on the new machines versus old machines and how all that stuff works and things like that. I received a question about that this week. So it should be a good show. Hang on, stay tuned. We're going to just jump right into it. So first story I want to talk about this week is an IDC report. They came out with a report saying that Apple Watch sales declined 71% year over year in the third quarter of 2016. So pretty shocking number, and not looking too good for Apple. You know, Apple doesn't provide any actual numbers, so anything that IDC is doing is based on estimates. And they estimated that Apple sold 1.1 million units in the third quarter of 2016. Now, the IDC report was covering wearables in general, so not just smartwatches, but the whole wearables category. So as you might imagine, Apple didn't do too well in the overall rankings. They came in at the fifth position. Now, when this report hit, there was a lot of coverage, a lot of negativity being thrown out there. Well, Tim Cook jumped in and responded through a statement to Reuters, where he said Apple Watch sales set a record during the first week of the holiday shopping season, and that the current quarter for Apple Watch is on track to be one of the best ever for the company. He also pointed out that his numbers are actual sell-through numbers to consumers, whereas typically sales numbers, when they're being reported by an organization like IDC, that can be any sales that go even into retailers, into the channel. So not necessarily products ending up in the hands of customers. Now, another thing that's, I think, important to point out with this this number that might have been missed was that the IDC numbers were for the third quarter of 2016. And as you know, Apple did not have new Apple Watches in the lineup until mid-September. So there's likely a lot of consumers that were waiting on Apple Watch. So you really can't compare third quarter of 2015 to third quarter of 2016, at least in terms of Apple Watch numbers, because a lot of us were waiting around wanting to buy the new ones, the Series 2. And I think a lot of people did. So really, the fourth quarter numbers are going to be the telling tale as to what's happening with Apple Watch. And once again, we're only going to be able to speculate on that because Apple doesn't give us actual numbers. It just falls in that other category when they announce. But Tim's saying, hey, Apple Watch sales are pretty good. And there's other evidence that kind of seems to be pointing to that. Checking on Amazon, I did notice that in the smartwatch best-selling category, that the Apple Watch 42-millimeter Series 0, the original Apple Watch Sport, is the only one in the top 10. So maybe that doesn't look so good. But then there was a report from Slice Intelligence. They monitor online orders, basically order receipts going out to customers. And they claim that Apple is getting 46.6% of the holiday revenue for wearables. And so that would seem to back up Tim's statement that sell-through on Apple Watch is actually pretty good for the holiday season. Now, you do need to note that the Slice numbers are talking about 46% of revenue, not actual unit sales. So this is, once again, when we're talking numbers, we always have to remember, what are we looking at here? And for Apple, you know, they make good profit off of the units they sell. They may not sell in the volume or as many as, say, Fitbits that are out there, but Fitbits aren't making that much revenue on each unit sold. So it's really hard to do those sorts of comparisons. And we always have to remember, when these numbers come out, take note of what you're looking at, what they're telling us, and sort of what that actually means, or how you kind of translate that. But I have no reason to believe that Apple Watch sales aren't doing very well, and that we can't sort of take Tim Cook at his word. I'll tell you, just looking around and seeing people walking about, I see a lot of Apple Watches out there in the marketplace, and not with just tech nerdy people. It seems to be getting out in larger numbers. And I think the recent changes with the price points and bringing a lower price point to the Series 0 and the Series 1 watches is helping Apple a lot. So I'm going to take Tim Cook at his word, and we'll just have to wait to see how things shake out in the fourth quarter. We've been talking a little bit about the iPhone 6S shutdown issue. Apple has been addressing this. They actually have a repair and replacement program where you can go into an Apple store if you have an affected unit and get a replacement. We're going to talk a little bit more about that experience a little bit later in the show, but it looks like some of the issues may be more than just a hardware issue. Originally, and I think we talked about this last time, Apple had stated that the battery replacement program was needed because there was a small batch of iPhone 6S units that they believed were manufactured early in the cycle, where the battery components had been exposed too long to the air before they actually went into assembly. And this was causing the batteries to actually wear out sooner than expected. They now believe that there are some units outside that first batch that might also be experiencing random shutdowns, but they may be able to push out a software update to fix that. Right now, they're still investigating, but they think the units are shutting down to protect the electronic components. So it may just be some sort of software problem. Apparently, they're planning to put some additional diagnostic code in a future update. And actually, we just got an iOS update, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later. It may be possible that this new analysis or these new logging tools are in there, and we'll be reporting some of this back to Apple so they can see if there is a software fix that they might be able to issue. And after we started talking about this, I did receive emails from a few of you mentioning that, you know, I have an iPhone 6S and I'm having this problem, but I'm not in the serial number range for the replacement program. Apple's replacement program, you can actually go on their support website and check your phone, your iPhone 6S, if you've been experiencing the issue. But some people are noting that they're falling outside that range and they're still having the problem. So it looks like if you are experiencing that, Apple is aware of the issue, and hopefully there'll be a software fix for you relatively soon. And then just another small thing somewhat related to iPhones and batteries. There were these reports recently of at least 8 iPhones catching fire in China. And that was a little bit concerning, especially, you know, in the light of the whole Samsung Galaxy Note issue. Well, Apple's been doing an investigation, and they responded this week that they found that in all those cases, the fires were caused by what they're saying are external factors. Apple said that the units in question all had physical damage that led to, quote, thermal events. Apple didn't provide any specifics, of course, but they believed that impact damage was probably the issue. They cited a number of different issues, but it's sounding like they're sort of pointing at impact damage as being the potential cause in these cases. I just have to think also another problem can be counterfeit chargers. There was a recent study that found that 99% of quote-unquote Apple chargers, these are chargers that report to be official Apple chargers that are being sold online, are actually counterfeit. And I think we talked about that report in the last episode of the MacCast, or maybe we covered it on the Mac show over on the British Tech Network. But yeah, there was this study. They bought 400 different chargers that were Apple official branded chargers online, and 99% of them turned out to be counterfeit. They had them tested by the UL labs, and they found that these were not properly insulated, and that could also lead to phone damage, battery damage, and fires. So you want to make sure when you're buying an Apple branded charger that if the deal sounds too good to be true, it likely is. You're not going to get a $20 Apple official charger for $4.99. It's just not going to happen. So, you know, buyer beware on that. You can check logos. You can check those sort of things. They even mentioned prongs. And again, I think we covered that on the last episode of the MacCast. So if you missed that, go back and listen to that episode. As we've been also discussing on the last few MacCasts, the new MacBook Pros seem to be suffering from some early, I don't know if we call them growing pains. They're the typical first generation of a brand new or innovative design pains. There's a lot of new technologies in the new MacBook Pros, and we've been getting all kinds of different reports. Probably the biggest one that's been plaguing a lot of users is the reports of GPU issues. This is the issue where users are experiencing glitches on the new MacBook Pro, things like tearing, transparency issues, all the way up to and including complete system crashes, kernel panics, those sorts of things. Mostly these seem to be happening when the systems are under heavy load, doing things like video rendering operations. And in a number of cases, the problem seems to be related or isolated to using things like Adobe Premiere, specific applications from Adobe. It caused a member of the Mac Rumors Forum to actually email Craig Federighi and say, hey, what's going on here? What are you guys doing? Are you aware of this? He actually responded or reportedly responded. I think they were still trying to check the validity of the email. But according to the report, Federighi said the glitches have been fixed in macOS 10.12.2 beta. And so that should be coming out soon and hopefully will resolve the problems for a number of people. Now, unfortunately, there still are some reports of issues still existing, even for users running the 10.12.2 beta. Those are surfacing right now, so it's still not really 100% clear. Is this a hardware issue? Is this a software issue? I'm leaning toward the latter. I have a feeling they've got that new Polaris processor in there. There's probably some GPU software tweaking that needs to be done to kind of resolve this, and that seems to be what Federighi was implying in this email. So that's probably pretty good news if you are a MacBook Pro owner and you've been dealing with these problems. There also still seems to be growing complaints of battery life issues on the new machines. Many of the complaints seem to be more based on the estimated battery time remaining report. A lot of them are noting that, you know, you'll charge the unit up to 100%. Then you will take a look at the battery indicator, you know, click the icon in the menu bar, and you're looking at, you know, how much charge is estimated to be remaining. And that's coming through as showing as little as 3 hours of battery life left after you have 100% charge, which really you'd be concerned about. It's not good, right? You're supposed to have a unit that's going to get up to 10 hours of battery life, and it's reporting that. But one reason that thing is probably off and not really to be trusted is that it doesn't really know exactly what's going on with the system beyond exactly at that point in time. So depending upon what things you have running, what the GPU is using, that estimate is really not something to go off of. So that could be one issue that's happening, why we're seeing a lot more reports of people saying, oh, I'm only getting, you know, 3 to 6 hours of battery life. And that seems to be where the range that most people are reporting falling into, even in what they're calling light use of the system, and that would be far below Apple's advertised usage. Now, there are people who are actually using it until it actually dies and finding that they're only getting 3 to 6 hours. And I'm starting to see more and more reports like that. So I think this is the classic case where, yeah, there's some smoke here and there might be some fire as well. There might be more smoke than fires, though. And we're going to have to kind of gauge it and wait a little bit of time to figure out what's going on. Hopefully, again, Apple can address this with some software updates. But it's sounding like, in general, if you're getting a new MacBook Pro unit, don't expect to get up to 10 hours. You're probably going to fall more in the range of 6 hours or so, at least at this point. And if that continues to be the case, if Apple can't get a lock on that and get that number up, that does give a kind of another ding to this latest round of MacBook Pro, in my opinion, because the current generations, the 2015 ones, do have excellent battery life and do very much reach up in that 8-10 hour range. At least that's been my experience with my unit, and a lot of people have reported that. So again, hopefully what we're seeing right now in terms of the MacBook Pro problems is just growing pains. It's Apple, you know, getting new units into the hands of millions of potential new users, and they're just working out the kinks. And that always seems to happen. You know, it's not fun when you're going through it. If you've just got your new machine and you're looking at it going, wow, I'm getting really sucky battery life, that's not a great place to be in. But ride it out for a little while. Hopefully, again, it will level out, it will level off, and we'll start, you know, hearing about, hey, this issue's been fixed. Another problem being reported by Tidbits is that, unfortunately, some new MacBook Pros seem to be having an unexpected shutdown issue. And this one is quite specific. So it's only impacting a few types of users. In testing, Tidbits found that the issue was linked to copying large files between external drives that are connected through the Thunderbolt 3 over the USB-C ports. It seems to be limited to that scenario. Copying from the internal drive to an external seems okay. It also seems to be okay if you just have one drive connected at a time. But when you have multiple drives connected to multiple ports on the new MacBook Pro, not through a hub, if you go through a hub, that seems to be okay as well. But if you have them connected to multiple ports, it seems like it's triggering this shutdown issue. And more frequently, the shutdown issue seems to happen when you're doing backup operations, and that be through Time Machine or even through some other third-party app. Again, this is all in Tidbits limited testing, but they seem to be able to reproduce it. As a matter of fact, the piece that they wrote up notes that they were unable to replicate the issues, unfortunately, when they took their unit into the Apple Store just trying to copy large files through the Finder. They actually had to be using the backup utilities to get it to trigger, and they didn't have those at the store at the time. Although in the testing leading up to going to the Apple Store, apparently it was doing the crash in the Finder. So the only theory that exists right now is that it might somehow be related to the power draw on the various drives. And once again, hopefully this is an issue that Apple, once they're made aware of it, can address in software. So if you've been suffering from this problem, you probably want to send Apple some feedback. Let them know your unit is having some trouble. And some people who have reported this issue have been contacted by Apple. And again, they're doing diagnostics. They're looking at this to try and nail down this problem. So that's the good news on that side. But once again, you know, more things that are happening where we've got new units out there and people aren't having the best experience. And that's not always great for Apple or for the customers. Now, the MacBook Pro was the only Mac that saw a significant update here in 2016. And that was pretty disappointing for a number of us who were maybe looking forward to some new iMacs, some new Mac Pros, something like that. Well, good news is that Apple Insider notes that the Hackintosh community may have discovered some new references in K-Text files in macOS 10.12.2 that seem to show additional Mac refreshes are at least being considered. When they will happen, we don't really know, but they noted that there are three different GPUs being referenced by the operating system update. A Polaris 10 model, the 10X T2, which is likely an improved version of the Polaris 10 series chips that we see in the current iMac lineup. There's also reference to a Polaris 12, which really doesn't map to anything currently in the AMD GPU lineup. So whether that's a new GPU or just, you know, sometimes they stick little references in there just to throw people off. That's been reported. So that may be that sort of thing. But, you know, assumption is that's a new potential GPU that could be showing up in a new Mac sometime in the future. And then there's also reference to a Vega 10, which is a GPU based on the AMD GCN architecture, also known as the Fury Pro. And that last one could be the most exciting reference because it is a higher-end GPU that's more suited for like a Mac Pro or a high-end Retina iMac update. So, you know, fingers crossed. Hopefully these references mean that Apple's working on some new machines. They're getting ready with the operating system to have that ready to go when they launch these. And we'll see some updates maybe early in 2017. I know a lot of people would like to see that, especially on the Mac Pro side of things. You know, Apple really needs to give their pro consumers something to get very excited about. I don't think this MacBook Pro update has been it. I'm also one of those, as you know, we mentioned this on the last show, I'm one of those people that's kind of holding out hope that we may see a MacBook Pro update when new GPUs from Intel, the new Kaby Lake processors, come out and become available. And those are expected to be announced at CES in January. So it may be a pretty good first half of the year for us Mac fans should all of this stuff come to fruition. So I'm holding out hope that, you know, we're going to put 2016 behind us and 2017 is going to be a little bit better year for Mac fans. Also expected in 2017, of course, is new iPhones. It's expected to be a pretty big update, being the 10th anniversary of the release of the iPhone. An interesting report came out this week from Mac Takara saying that Apple may be considering a new color for 2017, that color being red, a new red case design to come into the lineup. You know, we've discussed the belief that Apple will introduce three different models of the iPhone in 2017. There's supposedly going to be a major new design, an all-glass design, glass front and back, the iPhone 8, possibly with an OLED screen. And it's also expected that Apple will sort of rev update the iPhone 7 and iPhone 7 Plus designs. The Mac Takara report seems to be indicating that the new color would come in those updated 7 and 7 Plus models, and they're actually referencing them in the report as the 7S and the 7S Plus, which is a little bit unusual because everything else we've been hearing to date is that Apple's going to skip the S generation this time around and go straight with iPhone 8. As a matter of fact, in his reports, KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo said that all of these designs would feature all glass cases and wireless charging, but because of this new color, the Mac Takara piece seems to somewhat dispute that, indicating that Apple would go with an iPhone 7 and or 7S and 7S Plus rev that would feature new processors. They're also saying that those would have the wireless charging, but would still have a colored case, indicating that it would be more the, you know, more like the existing designs, with the iPhone 8 or the highest end iPhone featuring the new all glass design and the OLED screen. Now, that's something in the report that concerns me a little bit because Ming-Chi Kuo seems to think that the top of the line iPhone 8 with the OLED screen would be a new massive 5.8 inch model with like a 5.2 inch display. These wraparound edges, and for me, not a big fan of the gigantophones. You know that if you've been listening to the show for a while. So if Apple only has the new design in the highest-end model and then sticks with the existing designs for the 4.7 and the 5.5-inch designs, that's going to be a little bit of a disappointment to me. So I'm hoping these rumors are sort of conflicting. As we know, this early on, Apple's doing a lot of prototype designs. They're messing around with a lot of things. So we have to kind of take all of these rumors with a grain of salt. I think ultimately Apple's going to go with an all-new design across the board. I do think there is going to be a premium model at the very top end. That one is probably going to get the OLED display. They'll probably go with the existing display technology on the bottom two models, the 4.7 and the 5.5-inch, but really just speculation at this point. Another thing that's a little bit of speculation but is looking like it may be the case is that TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, may be the exclusive supplier of Apple's new processor, the A11. This comes from Nikkei. They claim that the company is working to deliver samples based on their latest 10-nanometer process in the first quarter of the year. They were originally hoping to capture about two-thirds of Apple's chip business, with the remainder of the business probably going to Samsung. But now the reports say that they may once again be the exclusive supplier of Apple's processors for the iPhone. Also interesting in the report is that they are already working on new 5-nanometer and 3-nanometer chip making processes for future processors. So it's amazing to me how they keep driving down the nanometer processes from, I think we're at 14-nanometer being the smallest now, down to 10 next year and moving into 5 and 3-nanometer designs. All of the sort of shrinking of these processors helps with the thermal profile and the performance of the chips. And that means we get, you know, faster, lighter, longer lasting, slimmer, as much as some people don't think we need slimmer anymore, slimmer devices. And it's what enables some of the innovative designs to happen. So processor design technology continues to advance at what I think is a pretty rapid pace. We may finally know the answer to the million-dollar question here at the end of the year. What the heck happened to cause the AirPods not to ship in October, as Tim Cook had promised at the September Apple event? Well, the Wall Street Journal reported last week that a source told them the issue was actually a problem with getting the audio to stay in sync. What we know is that with most current Bluetooth wireless headphone systems, even the ones that are separated without a cord between the two earpieces, is that the way they work is one earpiece receives the signal and then transmits that signal to the other earpiece. So they're able to keep the audio synced fairly easily. They kind of use a little mesh system where one earpiece talks to the other earpiece. Now, what we've known about the AirPod design is that they are designed to operate with just one earpiece at a time, and it can be either one, which means that the iPhone has to be able to send the signal to each earpiece independently. As a matter of fact, even reportedly, you'll be able to buy and replace just one single unit. So each EarPod is kind of created equal when it comes to receiving the audio signal. So that is, according to this report, where the trouble started. Each earpiece needs to get its own signal from your device, and reportedly they're having problems keeping those signals in sync. And if they're not in sync, then you're going to get a real bad audio experience. What still baffles me, though, is that how could Apple have not known this was a problem before the September event? And also, they've had these units, they've had demo units or early units in the hands of many reviewers, and not a single one of those reports has reported having this problem. Well, as a matter of fact, John Gruber is one of the people that has these EarPods, and he has said he's had no issues with it. So we may actually not have the answer that we were looking for as to specifically what happens. As a matter of fact, I think Gruber notes that what he's hearing is that there's just been manufacturing problems that were unexpected when they tried to scale up production. So getting the units produced in volume, there's some sort of issue going on there. Again, we really don't know what that is. Some have speculated or wanted to say that it may be an issue with the new W1 wireless chip. But Apple already has a couple different models of Beats out on the market. I think the Beats Solo 3 wireless, I'm probably getting the name wrong. They have the Power Beats headphones, both which are using the W1 chips and are shipping. We did get a report this week, or a rumor this week, that the third set of Beats headphones using the W1, the Beats Power Beats X or the Beats X phone headphones, those are delayed as well. So I think this is sort of an unrelated thing. I wonder if maybe they're holding back W1 chips from those, which is causing that delay, so that they can possibly get the AirPods out the door and have enough supply to actually meet demand. But there is a late report that just came out, again, sourcing from John Gruber. He says he's got a couple people telling him, although he does note they're not exactly his most reliable sources, but he does say he has some well-placed sources that are saying Apple is trying to get out the AirPods before the end of the year, that in the next couple days, they may have some AirPods actually shipping. But he does say, even if they do that, that your chances of actually getting your hands on a set of them are going to be slim to none, because there is going to be very, very minimal availability. Now, I read this report or heard this report and thought immediately, this is the worst thing that Apple could do. If this turns out to be true, this is a huge mistake, in my opinion. They've already missed the window for the holidays. They've already disappointed everybody who's been waiting on AirPods. And I think they would only make matters worse by saying, oh, they're here, and then not having enough availability to meet hardly any demand. You know, the fact that you would try to walk into an Apple store, it would just infuriate and continue to make the situation worse. You'd have angry customers who are already angry that these things aren't available, made even more angry by the fact that you're saying they're available and they can't get their hands on them. At this point, I would wait. I would again get supplies up. And that's why I'm hoping that this delay with the other Beats headphones is Apple saying, look, we're going to reserve all of the W1 chips that we can get our hands on right now to go into the AirPods, because we want to meet the demand that we know is going to be extremely high for those units. Release those when they're ready, when they have enough supply in the supply chain to get them into Apple stores, into the hands of the customers that want them, without delays immediately. We don't want any more delays at this point. So, you know, Apple, wait another month or another 3-4 weeks so that that can happen. I think that's the right thing to do. But, you know, again, we may not know exactly why the AirPods are delayed, but I think Apple's best bet at this point is to, when they do release them, make sure that customers are happy and the customers that want them can get them. Here's a cool little change that Apple recently made to their support website that just kind of slipped out there quietly, but I think this is pretty cool. You probably know, if you've ever dealt with Apple support online, that you can go to the support website. If you're having a problem, they kind of now put you through this little wizard where you answer a number of different questions, and at some point, if you're still having issues, if you can't resolve it sort of on your own, through Apple's discussion forums or through some of the support articles that they have there, it will give you some options. It will give you some options to maybe contact Apple support via chat or via the phone, or maybe even send in your device to Apple. And one of those options is, hey, I want to make a Genius Bar appointment. I want to go in. I want to bring my device, whatever I'm having issues with, in for repair. And there you can search and find the closest Apple store near you or Genius Bar to take that in. Well, this change that they made is now it will not only list the closest Apple store or Genius Bar, it will actually list the closest support center to you, the closest Apple authorized service provider. They are now being included in that little list. And even better than that, it not only will show you those locations near you that are Apple authorized service providers, but also show you availability, just like it does with the Genius Bar. And anybody who's tried to get a Genius Bar appointment recently knows the frustration that goes along with that, because you cannot get a same day appointment. You often can't get a next day appointment. Sometimes you can't even get a within the next 3 days appointment, depending upon your local Apple store. So the ability to actually take it to an Apple authorized service provider, and they are at the same tier as the Genius Bar. They can do all of your Apple Care coverage repairs. They can get all the same components from Apple. it is a viable option, and it may be a closer, faster option for you to get service. So I think this is a great change on Apple's website. I'm looking forward to it, and hopefully I don't have a repair that needs to go in anytime soon, but when and if I do, I'm happy that this is now an option and that Apple has finally opened that system up. I think it's great, and I look forward to hearing your reports on how that works for you, because I know there's a number of you that are in locations where you don't have a conveniently located Apple retail store, but you probably have a close-by Apple-authorized service provider. So hopefully this works out great. Hopefully the system is robust and works well. And if you have experienced the system, let us know how it went. Shoot us some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Apple seems to be kind of pushing out some of the promised features that they gave us at their recent events here late in the year. Apple has finally launched the single sign-on for Apple TV. Of course, it comes with some serious caveats. It was a feature that was supposed to arrive with tvOS 10, but ended up being delayed. It's the feature that allows you to sign in with your cable or satellite TV account credentials into just one location, one app, and then all of the apps or channels that are associated with your cable subscription or your satellite subscription then become active. You don't have to like reauthorize for every single station or channel within your system. Great feature. A lot of people were very much looking forward to it. Unfortunately, the downside is that it is out and available, but it's US only and only on some providers and only for some apps and channels. So they're still kind of trying to get that TV provider and partner support. Mostly it's the satellite systems, also CenturyLink, GVTC, GTA, Hawaiian Telcom, Hotwire, Metrocast, and Sling, which Sling is actually just a straight online streaming live TV service. So just those providers, and again, just a few channels. So probably not exactly what everybody is looking for, but at least it's starting to roll out, and hopefully in the future, more providers and more apps will be added relatively quickly. Bloomberg also says that Apple is in talks with the movie studios to try and get movie rentals on the Apple TV a little bit sooner, actually as soon as two weeks after they appear in the theaters. So you could be able to start to rent movies on your Apple TV through iTunes even while they're still in the theaters. The studios seem to be very concerned, though, about the encryption and piracy implications of releasing stuff early, although I don't really understand that. I don't understand, you know, if they're willing to put out rentals there now, you know, why would piracy somehow be less secure or encryption less secure? Apple uses FairPlay DRM, and as far as I know, most people haven't figured out how to crack that. They also, use DHCP and a bunch of the other technologies to protect that content. I just don't see rampant piracy happening, even if they allow Apple to start renting films while they're still in the theaters. At this point, though, it does seem to be just talks going on. There are no deals in place. The one option that the studios seem to like is a high early release rental fee in the range of $25 to $50 US if you're trying to rent it in the first few weeks. And while that may seem extremely high, when you compare that to the cost of actually going to the theater, getting the movie tickets can cost a lot more than that, especially if you have more than two or three people in your party. So this could be a viable option. I know there's a number of people that will opt to watch a movie at home and would be willing to pay the higher price. And so if that's what it takes to get the deal done, to kind of get the ball rolling, I'm all for Apple giving that a shot. I think a lot of people would opt in for that. I'm not so sure I would for a lot of films. I'd probably just wait for the standard, you know, rental release date to come around, but maybe for some films. And for a lot of films, I would still choose to go to the theater. Now, there are films like, for example, coming out this week, Star Wars Rogue One. There's no way I'm not seeing that in the theater with the full theater experience. But maybe some other, you know, comedies or lighter movies, I might opt to see those sort of first run in my living room, and I may be willing to pay $25 for the privilege. I'm not so sure I'd pay $50, but it'll be interesting to see if Apple can get this deal done, and it's good to know that they're actually at least trying. And then kind of related to all of this, Apple also released the latest iOS, tvOS, and watchOS updates. I say related because in iOS 10.2 and tvOS 10.1, they're bringing the new TV app that they promised finally to Apple TV and iOS. The TV app on iOS actually replaces your video app. So if you run the update for iOS 10.2, expect that to happen. You'll find all your movies and TV shows now inside the new TV app. I love the new TV app. I think I talked about this, the whole new What's Next feature. That's kind of the main interface, and it keeps track of all of the shows that you're watching, regardless of which channel or which app it's in or on which device. And you can kind of move seamlessly between one device or another, pick right back up where you left off. You're also getting all of your recommendations based on the channels that you have access to and the content that you're actually watching across the various channels. So it's actually really nice. My only disappointment or frustration with it is it currently does not support Netflix. Hopefully Netflix will come on board relatively soon. A few of the other updates that you'll find in iOS 10.2, there are over 100 new emoji. There's new message effects. There's new wallpapers. Yeah, not a lot of, you know, sort of major new feature enhancements, but there are also a lot of bug fixes and improvements. So if you've been suffering from some various issues, I know I've had a few what it seems like battery issues that I'm hoping got resolved with iOS 10.2 coming from 10.1.1. You're probably going to want to update. And in case you're wondering, on the watch side, watchOS 3.1.1 is mostly just bug fixes and improvements. If you've listened to the show for a while, you probably know that I am a big fan of Apple Pay. I love Apple Pay. I have my Apple Watch. It's my actual preferred way to pay when I can use it. But you also know that one of my frustrations has been that Apple has seemed to have been focused mostly on getting bank partners online, but in my opinion, not doing much to get Apple Pay available at retailers. You know, having Apple Pay support from your bank is great, but if I can't actually use it at the places where I buy stuff, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Well, some good news this week. Apple's VP, who runs their e-commerce and digital payments, Jennifer Bailey, spoke at the Code Commerce event and said that now 35% of merchants in the U.S. are taking Apple Pay, and that is up from just 4% 2 years ago. So they've made significant headway in the U.S., at least, in getting Apple Pay support at more merchants. Now, this isn't all Apple's doing. She did note that a big driving factor behind this is the new chip readers that a lot of merchants are putting into place. Those support the NFC that's also needed to make Apple Pay work. Of course, they do have to enable that, and a lot of retailers have chosen to disable it, which is frustrating. But the fact that those new machines that are going in, that's actually helping drive Apple Pay adoption. She also notes that the frustration that a lot of people are having with the new chip transactions, the slowness complaints that people have, the beeping at you annoyingly when you've left your card in there too long, those are all consumer experiences that consumers are not enjoying. And a lot of those go away when you're using Apple Pay. As a matter of fact, this happened for me because at my local grocery store, I found that I could pay a lot quicker and with a lot less hassle using Apple Pay versus having to stick my chip into their chip reader. It's not a huge difference. You know, a lot of people want to make this sound like, wow, chip cards totally suck. I don't kind of feel that way. I feel like it is a little bit slower. It's a little bit more frustrating. And Apple Pay for me is just really quick. And I would say for me, Apple Pay works about 90% of the time. About 10% of the time, I'll try it and it will kind of fail. But that seems an acceptable amount to me. And, you know, who knows what's going on at any one given moment with the machine or something like that. You know, I would probably say 10% of the time I encounter a chip reader or a swiper that's not working as well. So, you know, that doesn't fall out of the realm of possibility. But it's good to know that Apple Pay is progressing. Apple Pay is also now available in 12 different countries. And Tim Cook has said that in September, Apple Pay transactions had increased 500% year over year. So people are also getting more comfortable, and we're seeing more people using Apple Pay. And in the Code Commerce, at the Code Commerce event, rather, Jennifer Bailey also said something that I was happy to hear, that Apple is now focusing on creating new partnerships with not only banks, but with merchants. They're trying to incentivize more merchants to take advantage of Apple Pay to promote it. And I think that is something Apple really needs. And she also teased a little bit, saying that Apple is now thinking beyond Apple Pay. They're thinking about, quote unquote, everything in your wallet. Of course, no specifics were given, but I would imagine we can kind of predict what that may be. You know, rewards cards is one place to start, maybe membership cards to different services and things like that. Even all the way through driver's licenses, there were reports a while back that Apple was looking into technologies that would allow and make driver's licenses in a digital system like Apple Wallet acceptable for law enforcement and governments and things like that. So we could actually someday get to the point where the iPhone is the only device that we need to carry around, and it's going to have all of our stuff in it. We can dump the wallet. We don't have to have the George Costanza, you know, lopsided wallet problem. And I look forward to that day. I think that's going to be great. Had you asked me a couple of years ago if Apple would ever make iPhones in the United States, I probably would have immediately just turned around and said yes. And even up until recently, it seemed sort of like a crazy idea. But this past week, there was a CNBC story that alleged that Foxconn actually is planning to invest $7 billion in expanding its operations into the United States, and that that expansion could generate or result in up to 50,000 new U.S. jobs. The report claims that the plans are to build a collection of U.S.-based assembly plant. Now, Foxconn responded to the CNBC story saying that they were in talks with U.S. officials about the possibility, but that details would come when and if the talks were complete. So Foxconn is not saying that they are committing to this or anything like that. This was just sort of a leaked thing based on a slide, I think, that came out of a meeting between President-elect Trump and the CEO of Japan's SoftBank. They're working on this technology fund. And after that meeting, SoftBank did announce that they were pledging a $50 billion investment in U.S. expansion, and that they also were planning on trying to create about 50,000 new U.S. jobs as well. Foxconn currently actually operates facilities in the U.S., in Virginia and Indiana, and they also have logistics services in California and Texas. So it's not like they're adverse to opening up locations in the United States. And another thing that is changing the possibility of actually Foxconn opening up some manufacturing facilities, some assembly facilities here in the States, is that there's actually changing economic dynamics that are going on in China. There's governmental political factors, as well as just socioeconomic factors that are changing. They've got a growing middle class. Labor costs are going up in China. And actually, I've done a little research into this recently, and China is getting pretty close to the U.S. in terms of overall costs for labor. Now, Tim Cook personally has said always that it's not the cost of workers that is keeping them from opening up factories in the U.S. It's more the lack of workers with the proper vocational skills, that we just don't focus on generating the kinds of highly skilled factory workers that they would need here in the U.S. And that there's been a much more of a focus on that in China. We used to do that, but we've moved away from it. And we're talking about here just about 50,000 jobs. So this isn't going to, you know, overnight change things, but it certainly is becoming a possibility. And another thing that I discovered as I was doing my research is that, and I had no idea this was the case, because I assumed that one of the reasons Apple did assembly in China was just the geographic closeness that they have to where component parts come from. That, you know, most component parts are made in China or Taiwan, and just logistically, why ship them all the way back to the U.S. or some other location when you have everything right there? Well, it turns out that that is not true either. There was a huge study done by the University of Ireland and the University of China, and they found that most of the major component parts for iPhones and iPads actually come from China, followed by the U.S. It was like 32% China, 28% U.S., 19% Taiwan, about 6.5% Europe, and just about 3%, I think, actually came from China. We're talking about the major, you know, important component parts, not things like little things like screws and fasteners and that sort of thing, but the big major components actually come from areas outside of China. So it's not that crazy to think that maybe Foxconn could put a factory in the U.S. And as a matter of fact, Apple reportedly asked both Foxconn and Pegatron, their two main assembly companies, to look into the possibility of at least doing some iPhone production in the U.S. And Foxconn agreed, Pegatron actually declined. So it could happen. Is it going to be a huge revolution? No. Could it be something that slowly happens over time? Yes. Also, manufacturing is moving out of China to other locations that are maybe more affordable than the U.S. Countries like India, Brazil, other places like that are also becoming more attractive to manufacturers. And Foxconn is looking at and opening plants in those regions as well. So this just isn't a U.S. thing, but it's kind of cool to think that the possibility of Apple actually having an iPhone factory in the U.S. is not out of the realm of possibility at this point. So I thought that was kind of a pretty cool story. Another change we have been trying to make recently here on the MacCast is to cover a little bit more international news. And I figured the best way to do that is kind of do a little international news segment every once in a while when something interesting pops up. Sometimes there's no stories. Sometimes there's one or two. This week I've got one for you that stood out for me, a 4-year legal battle. And you know, I don't like to cover legal stories, but I found this one particularly interesting. A 4-year legal battle in Denmark is now over because a court ruled that Apple must replace a Danish man's iPhone 4 with a new model rather than a refurbished one. That case actually came up from because of Apple's longtime practice, and anybody who's ever had a device replaced probably knows this, of replacing iOS devices, specifically iPhones, that are under Apple Care warranty with factory reconditioned or refurbished models. You very rarely will get a new, brand new, packaged off-the-shelf model. You get a refurb. And what Apple does is they take in broken devices or older devices, and then they repair and refurbish them, put them back into like new devices, and then those are what are served up as replacements. And in this case, this is what happened. The Danish customer got a replacement. It was factory reconditioned, or it was a refurbished model. He was not happy with that. He made a complaint to the Denmark Consumer Complaints Board, and they sided with him and told Apple, hey, you have to give this guy a new model. Well, Apple fought that, and they actually sued the Danish customer. It went to court, and now a judge has ruled that, no, this guy's right. This is a violation of the country's Danish Sale of Goods Act, and Apple, you have to give him a new device as a replacement. You can't give him a refurbished model. Now, Apple can appeal to a higher court, but I really hope they don't do so. It just seems silly to me at this point. They might want to do it, though, because this would set a precedent and sort of set the law of how they have to operate in Denmark. But it sounds like it's within their existing laws that this is how they have to operate. So I'm hoping that Apple doesn't fight this. There already actually is another case in court right now where Apple has been ordered by Dutch officials to replace a woman's iPhone 6 Plus with a new model and not a refurbished one. The only question I have after all of this is, where the heck is Apple going to find a new iPhone 4 to give this guy? I have no idea. No, seriously, I hope they actually just give him a brand new iPhone 7. I think that would be the right thing to do. But interesting story in international news this week. And then finally, the last story I have for you is a little bit of an update on something we covered on the last episode of the MacCast. This is the iCloud calendar junk calendar entries. This was a problem that surfaced kind of over the Black Friday, Thanksgiving holiday period, where a number of us found that, hey, we had an offer for Ray-Ban sunglasses in our calendar as a calendar event. And there was no way to really decline or avoid that without actually sending a notification back to the spammers, letting them know, hey, you've got a valid email address. Well, actually, there is a way to do that. We covered that on the last episode of the MacCast, so if you missed that, go back and listen. But we also mentioned that Apple is looking into the issue, that they were starting to try and block some of this calendar spam on the server side, and it looks like they're moving forward with some additional fixes because they just rolled out a patch to iCloud.com that allows you to report calendar entries as spam and remove them from your calendar without actually alerting the sender. And you also can send a report to Apple so that they can further investigate and shut it down. This is a great step in the right direction. Unfortunately, right now, you do have to log on to iCloud.com to access it. And as many of you know, if you're on an iOS device, you can't go to iCloud.com and access your calendar. You have to go through the app. So hopefully this is just a first step and they're actually going to roll some updates right into the calendar app on Mac OS and on iOS soon that will bring the same report junk functionality. But at least we're moving forward. And hopefully this is nipped in the bud and we don't have to continue to deal with junk mail showing up in our, or junk events, I guess, rather, showing up in our calendar. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Eero. You know, let's face it, for a lot of us, wireless connectivity in our home has become a essential utility. It's probably at the same level as electricity. I was going to say water, but that may be taking it a little bit too far. But you get the idea. If you don't have working, reliable Wi-Fi servicing your entire house, we freak out. Your family's not going to be happy. And if you've ever tried things like repeaters or range extenders to try and reach those sort of dead zones in your house, you know that is a lesson in frustration. It really doesn't do anything to address some of the underlying issues. I've never had much success for it. And that's where a whole house wireless system like the Eero comes in, because it uses advanced wireless mesh networking technology to cover your whole house in fast, reliable Wi-Fi. And what I love about it is how easy it is to set up. You get one Eero unit, you replace your existing router with that, and then you add additional units to provide coverage to all of the other areas of your house. And they work together, and the setup is super easy. It's literally just plug and play. You plug in the next unit, and you use an app on your mobile device or tablet that walks you through the entire setup process. It connects everything together, and you're up and running within minutes. My system was set up within a matter, I think it was 15 minutes, maybe, if that. And I had my whole house covered. And a typical U.S. house can be covered by two or three Eero units, and they offer a convenient three-pack, so that's really a great place to start if you're wondering what to get. Another great thing is they provide excellent real-person customer support, so if you do get into trouble, which you're not going to because it's so easy, but if you do, you can call them up. They'll help you right out. And another great thing is they're constantly updating and improving their system through automatic software updates. So it's not like, you know, your old system where you have to apply firmware updates and you have to remember to do it. They've pushed out over 12 updates since the Eero was released, and they are adding cool new features all the time, like parental controls. They also recently improved the mesh technology, upgraded it to what they're calling True Mesh, made it even better. And they added the ability to integrate your Eero with your Amazon Echo. And this is really cool. You can use it to find other devices throughout your house based on which Eero they're closest to. You can pause your internet. So if you're sitting down to dinner, turn the internet off. Get your family focused back on dinner and on family time. And you can also turn off the Eero's LEDs at bedtime using your Amazon Echo. And of course, with Amazon, you can script all that stuff and create great little things to do that, all supported by the latest Eero updates. And plus, the Eero system looks great. It looks like something Apple would have designed, so you don't have to be embarrassed to have your unit sitting out there on your shelf. And so if you're looking to give your Wi-Fi a boost in performance and reliability, a new Eero system, I think, is a really smart choice. And plus, right now, you can get expedited shipping for free. Visit Eero.com. That's Eero.com. And then when you check out, enter the code MACCAST, and you will get free expedited shipping on your order. A big thank you to Eero for their support of the MACCAST. Last time on the show, we were doing a little bit of follow-up on the whole iPhone, and I'm going to probably get this wrong again, 6 Plus. It's the 6 Plus, right, that was suffering the touch disease issue. Hopefully I'm getting that right. We got some more feedback this week, this time from listener Ben.
Hey, Adam. My name's Ben. I'm calling from Deniliquin in Australia. I just wanted to touch on what Jason had to say in last week's episode about the touch disease. I also had a iPhone 6 Plus. We were out for tea one night, and one of my friend's kids accidentally bumped it off the table, and it dropped onto the concrete and smashed. Now, that phone was working perfectly, but when I sent my phone via mail in, because I live a long way from an Apple store, back to Apple, they sent me because I've got AppleCare Plus, sent me a refurbished phone to replace the one that had dropped, and it had the touch disease right out of the box. It was flickering and had all the symptoms of touch disease. So, to the point, actually, sometimes where I had to physically twist the phone so I could unlock the phone and get into the home screen to use my phone properly. I sent that phone back to Apple. They just swapped it out, no problems. And, yeah, I just thought that was interesting. So brand-new refurbished phone straight out of the box with the touch disease symptoms. All right, Adam, thanks very much. I love your show. I listen every week. See you later.
Hey, Ben, thanks for your feedback. Yeah, your story brought up something that I had not really considered or thought about, and that this could be a potential issue with a lot of the replaced devices for what we were talking about earlier in the news segment, right? Apple replaces a lot of these devices with quote-unquote refurbished phones, and the way they get those refurbished phones is they're taking in repairs and they're using parts that they have tested and considered to be good. But the touch disease issue is actually a longer-term issue, right? Eventually, over time, things happen, either flexing of the phone, no one really knows for sure, but flexing of the phone, heat, something like that, that little IC chip becomes desoldered. And now when Apple, you know, sends those out, it's possible you could kind of have this like little ticking time bomb. Yours obviously happened right out of the box right away, and luckily Apple stood behind it and replaced it, and I think that's a good thing. And I'm really hoping that Apple is now that they're aware of the whole quote-unquote touch disease problem, they're aware of this issue, that they're looking at the replacement history when someone has this problem. Because, again, they're alleging that the whole thing is caused by user damage, that you've dropped the phone too many times, and that's caused the chip and the solder points to break, and that's why you're experiencing touch disease. And they're asking people to spend, to pay $150 for the repair. It would really stink if you got a replacement device that already had symptoms of the problem or was developing symptoms of the problem, even if it's because of the reason Apple said, right, that it was dropped. You don't know that it was dropped. And Apple often, I would imagine, when they're taking in the devices that they're using for refurbs, they don't know how many times this has been dropped. And, you know, this issue is micro hairline cracks on the solder. I doubt they're looking at it microscopically to see. Maybe they will start to do that now. Who really knows? But I still wonder how many of these time bombs does Apple, you know, has Apple themselves put out into the wild? And it just brings up another reason why, like I mentioned on the last episode of the MacCast, it seems like Apple should just be covering this. This really feels more like a design flaw. They should know phones are going to get dropped, and if they have a weak point in the system design, in the board design, they should be doing something bigger to address that. So hopefully they've done that in, you know, future iPhone models or will. But for now, this problem still exists out there. And I think your story is a great example of where this really feels like this time around, you know, Apple is in the wrong in terms of, at least in my opinion, in terms of how they're handling it. So again, I continue to welcome anybody else's opinions or stories. You can send those in to me, MacCast at gmail.com. mac.com. Another thing that we've talked about recently is this whole battery replacement problem for people who have been impacted by shutdown issues with their iPhone 6S. I know that my particular unit that I have is covered under the warranty. I took mine in, and I'm going to share my story a little bit with you here in a second. But I also received a comment from Wayne, and this was his experience when he went to get his battery replaced.
Hey, Adam. This is Wayne Henderson from MediaVoiceOvers.com. I just wanted to call in because I'm one of the unfortunate iPhone 6S owners who has a model and serial number that was built during the time with the battery issues, and I'm having all sorts of battery issues. Needless to say, I contacted Apple support through Twitter direct messages. They looked things up. They created a case number. They had me set up an appointment with the Apple Store. So anyways, that took forever. I finally got into the Apple Store for my appointment with the case number and everybody knowing that I'm there to get my battery replaced. And guess what? That's right. They didn't have any more batteries. So after taking time off work and going to the Apple Store about an hour away, I left frustrated and just with a new case number. They're going to get a battery with my name on it. And then when it comes in about a week or so, I just have to go in without an appointment and trek back down there, leave my phone with them for a couple of hours. I thought, you know, maybe explain some of the other issues my phone's having, that they would just want to be nice and swap out my 6S for another 6S. I know that's asking a lot, but they didn't want to do that for less than $300. Basically, it's just very frustrating knowing that I'm coming in for a battery and they don't have a battery. And it's their problem for building a defective iPhone. I had the iPhone 1, the 3GS, the 4S, and the 5S. No problems at all. This 6S has been nothing but a bag of hurt. And it's just very frustrating. I'm sure other listeners are having the same issues. And it's like, come on. I hate to throw this out there, but if Steve Jobs were still alive, I don't think it'd be handled this same way. I have a feeling that this would be taken care of in a much more efficient manner. But anyways, I love the MacCast. I've been listening for like 11 years now, and I love it. Keep up the good work. See ya. Bye.
Hey, Wayne. Thank you for sending in your experience. Sorry it was a little bit on the negative side. It sounds like they're going to get you taken care of ultimately. I want to comment on the last sort of statement about the whole Steve Jobs thing. You know, I know that comes up from time to time. The reality, in my opinion, is that a lot of these changes to sort of how Apple handles repairs and Genius Bar appointments and stuff like that inside their retail stores, that all started, in my opinion, back in the days of Steve Jobs. So I'm not so convinced that this would go down differently. The other thing that you commented on that I think a lot of people don't realize, and this isn't an excuse, I think this is actually a problem and directly leads to your bad experience, is that when you contact Apple through the phone, through AppleCare online, or some other mechanism, there really is no, it's my understanding, and anybody who is, you know, in that world can correct me if I'm wrong, but I've been told several times that there really is no connection between the sort of on the phone support, online support, the chat support, and what happens at the Apple retail store. So yeah, you may have set up your appointment and you may have explained what the whole thing was for, but that really probably didn't trigger them ordering your battery and getting inventory and sort of setting things aside for you at the Apple retail store. It's just not how they do it. And it's interesting your experience, because it's almost exactly the same experience I had, just a little bit differently. I didn't start with online support because luckily for me, I have an Apple retail store nearby. So I just chose to go online, make an appointment at the Apple retail store and take my phone in. And when I took it in, they brought it in, they verified that it was, you know, in the affected batch, and they said, yep, we're going to do a battery replacement. But same answer, we don't have them in store right now. We've been doing a lot of these battery replacements. We don't have them in stock. We're going to have to order one. So we'll order it up for you. And when it comes in, we will contact you. Just come back in. It'll take about an hour to do the replacement, and we will, it'll all be taken care of. So I'm having to do sort of the same thing, not as inconvenient for me, but you know, it seems like everybody's having a similar experience. Now, I did get one report from another listener that was even worse than I think both you and I have it. And he was told he had to send his phone in to Apple for a replacement and that he was going to have to wait up to a week. So he still brought it into a retail store, but they took the phone in and they sent it out for the repair, which is a little bit unusual because I've been hearing that they were doing all of these battery replacements in store. I don't know why he had a different experience, but it was going to take up to a week for him to get his phone back. So at least you and I still have our phones on us and we're not having to wait. So there does seem to be mixed reports when it comes to the experience a lot of people are having. I know some people have even gotten lucky and the batteries happen to be in stock when they get in there for their appointment. But if you are in the list, if you're in sort of the running for getting your iPhone 6S battery replaced and you haven't gone through this experience yet, learn from Wayne's experience and my experience. You're probably going to be making two trips to the Apple store to get the repair done. I guess the other option would probably be to send it in through the mail. And many of you probably have had to go through that experience. So if you have had a different experience or want to share your own experience with the battery replacement program, shoot us an email or an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. One good thing, though, came out of me having to go into the Apple store, and that is I got to try out what is arguably going to be one of the biggest games of the year coming to iOS. On December 15th, in just a couple days, maybe even out by the time you hear this podcast, Super Mario Run, the first Mario game on iOS, is going to be out. And Apple has been hyping it since their September event. It's been a big deal. It was one of the first games on the App Store where you could sign up just for, like, to be notified when the app came out or was released. And last week, Apple announced that they were going to have a demo version up and running on all of the iPhones in the Apple Store. So I was in the Apple Store the day it was released for demo, and I got a chance to try it out. Early estimates are the game's going to be priced at $9.99 US. Early estimates are that they're going to generate $71 million in revenue probably in the first 30 days. Now, that's not the highest selling game. I think Nintendo's Pokemon Go app actually did better than that in the first month, but still, that's not chump change. That's a lot of app sales. And I had a chance to play with it, and I have to tell you, it is every bit as fun as it looked like in the demo. It is a really simple and straightforward concept. You know, one of the big things they're touting is you can actually play it with one hand because all you do is tap the screen to make Mario jump. So Mario automatically runs. He automatically jumps over obstacles and things like that. But what you're trying to do is collect coins and power-ups and things in the game. And in order to do that, you have to jump higher and get up to higher levels. So he can bounce off walls. He can bounce between the things. It's a little bit like a little parkour kind of thing. And you're trying to collect as many coins as you can. You're trying to bounce off obstacles and enemies to make that happen. You can somewhat change direction, although he's almost always moving forward, left to right, running across the screen. And there are special colored coins that you need to collect to kind of level up, and those will change color and get harder as you clear screens and collect more and more coins and get up to other levels, which I think adds replayability to the game. So you're going to run through the level, and you're probably going to be able to, you know, complete the levels pretty easily the first run through, but what you're going to do is you're going to miss a lot of power-ups, a lot of hidden things. You're not going to get all the coins. So if you're like me, you're going to be the kind of person that wants to go back and figure out, okay, how do I get that one coin that I haven't been able to reach? What's kind of the trick and what's the right tapping sequence? So it becomes more and more challenging because you can't really control the running. You can't go back and forth. So if you've missed some coins, the only way to get a second chance is to go back and replay the level and maybe do something different. So I think clearing all the coins is going to be a big challenge in the game. And you don't need to clear all the coins to actually clear the level and actually progress through the game. But I think that's where it's going to be the difference of just playing casually to be the type of person that is trying to actually, like, master the game. So I think it's going to appeal on a lot of levels, not only to just casual gamers, but to more hardcore gamers who are like, yeah, I want to get every coin. I want to get all the power-ups. I want to get all the secret stuff and find all the tricks. The download is actually going to be free And there is a one-time in-app purchase for the $9.99 that will get you access to the full game. Now, that's all the excitement that came out of me sort of trying out the game. The one potential downside that came out after the demo has been out for a while is that it was revealed that Mario, Super Mario Run, is going to require an always-on internet connection to play. So basically that means Mario can jump, but he can't fly, at least not on domestic or international flights, unless you pay for the in-flight Wi-Fi. It does need an internet connection. And Nintendo is saying that requirement is there because they're concerned, once again, about piracy. Piracy is an issue on iOS games, you know, and different developers feel differently about it. I guess Nintendo really feels that they need to heavily protect their intellectual property when it comes to this game, and specifically Mario. So they've chosen to make this choice. I think it's a bad idea. I think there's going to be a number of consumers that are turned off by this. And, you know, who knows, maybe they will actually reverse the decision. But for now, that's going to be the case at launch. So if that's a big deal for you, you maybe don't want to spend the $9.99 on this game. For me, I enjoyed it enough. I think I'm going to be spending my $10 on day one. You probably remember, if you've been listening to the MacCast for a while, when iTunes or Apple Music, I was going to say iTunes Music. No, when Apple Music came out and we already had the iTunes Match, there was a bit of confusion about sort of the crossover of the two services. Both iTunes Match and Apple Music gave you access to the iCloud music library, where any of the songs and music that you had in your Apple library, it would go through, it would match those things, and it would enable it inside the iCloud music library so that you could access your music from your other devices. Anything that was matched, you kind of had access to, and you could even potentially re-download higher quality versions. So if you had ripped versions, or you had versions that you had purchased that were at a lower bit rate, with iTunes Match, you could actually re-download the Apple AAC versions of those same tracks. Now, the difference was that if you only had a subscription to Apple Music, when you re-downloaded those matched tracks, they would come down in the Apple Music format, meaning that they had DRM attached to them. Whereas if you were an iTunes Match subscriber, even if you also had an Apple Music subscription, those same matched tracks, when they were re-downloaded from iCloud Music Library, would not have the DRM. So there was a specific reason to have iTunes Match along with an Apple Music subscription if you were worried about the DRM. Of course, your original tracks were always left untouched, so if you never tried to replace them, you didn't really have an issue if you were using Apple Music. But it was a big deal for some people, so the advice was, if you care about this stuff, keep iTunes Match and Apple Music. And as a matter of fact, on Apple's website, they even had an FAQ that sort of outlined this thing. Well, I guess this past week or so, Apple quietly changed that Apple Music membership FAQ. And under the question, do I need iTunes Match with Apple Music, they changed the answer from a maybe to an emphatic no. They now say that Apple Music includes all of the benefits of iTunes Match to make all of your music available on all of your devices. And so the big difference, the change that apparently has happened, is now for matched tracks, both within Apple Music and iTunes Music Match, tracks that are matched and uploaded or made available on iCloud Music Library, if you re-download those matched tracks, they will come across as 256 kilobit AAC files with a non-DRM, in a non-DRM format. And that's true if you're using iTunes Music Match. It's also true if you only have an Apple Music subscription. Now, again, this is only for matched tracks. I want to be very clear about that. That's not stuff that you don't own that you just download from Apple Music. According to the Loop's Jim Dalrymple, Apple has been gradually working on bringing the full iTunes Match capabilities to Apple Music subscribers, and it looks like, or it appears like with this change, that has finally happened. And I actually tested on this system and found that it did work for me, but you absolutely have to be careful when you're testing it out. This only works with matched files. And when I went into my library to look at this, I found out that I had at some point somehow messed up my library by removing, and I seem to remember, I think I deliberately did this because I decided I'm going to keep my Apple Music subscription forever. I don't really care if there's DRM on my files. I listen to them on my iOS devices, on my Apple TV, on my Mac. The DRM doesn't get in my way. So I just wanted the convenience of just give me everything in the Apple Music AAC 256 kilobit format. I want it all. And I just re-downloaded everything from Apple Music, including all the stuff that I had matched through my Apple Music subscription. I had canceled iTunes Match and I had just had Apple Music. So I said, give me everything. And so what I noticed was when I went back to test this, almost every file in my iTunes library was in the Apple Music format, meaning that it had DRM attached to it. I did that. It wasn't anything that Apple did. They didn't swap out my files without my knowing. Luckily, you know I'm fanatic about backup. I have full backups of everything. But for me to be able to clean things up at this point, what I'm going to need to do now that Apple has made this change is I'm going to have to go back through, delete and remove all of the Apple Music versions from iTunes and from my iCloud Music library, and then re-upload, rematch everything, remove the local download files that aren't in 256 kilobit format AAC, and then re-download all of those in their non-DRM'd versions from Apple Music. Yeah, it's going to be a big pain for me, but just be aware, if you're going to mess with this, you got to make sure that you're dealing with the matched tracks and it's stuff that you have locally that doesn't already have DRM applied to it. And you can do this pretty easily in checking your iTunes library. Just go to the music section, go to the songs view of your library, and then if you don't see the column, right-click on the column headings and enable the iCloud status column. I also like to turn on the bitrate column so I can see what's 256 kilobits or higher and what's not. But in the iCloud status column, it will either say something like Apple Music or matched or uploaded. And so what we're talking about here are those matched tracks. And of course, before you make any changes to your local iTunes music library, you should have a full backup. And I really recommend at least two full backups before you mess with this. But if you'd like to pull down Apple's AAC versions of your matched tracks, what you'll do is you'll want to turn on probably the iCloud download column. That's also accessed by just clicking in the songs view on the column header. Turn on iCloud downloads. That's going to give you the little, you know, download icon if you don't have that file already downloaded. You're going to want to select your matched tracks, and then you're going to control click or right click on those tracks and choose remove download. You just want to remove the local download files. You can choose to move them to the trash. Don't empty the trash yet, probably. But once you've removed them, then in the iCloud download column, you should see a little iCloud icon with the downward pointing arrow. That means they're up in your iCloud music library and can be re-downloaded. So then you can select those tracks with the little cloud icon, control click on them, again right click on them, and choose download. And when you download them, even if you're only an Apple Music subscriber, any of those matched tracks should come down as 256 kilobit AAC versions without DRM applied to it. Of course, if everything goes according to plan. So just be very methodical and very careful about doing this. It's very easy to mess it up and end up with something that you weren't intending to end up with, which is why you want to make sure you have a backup. But an interesting change that kind of probably slipped by for most of us this week. And then the last thing that I have for you in the MacCast this week is a great question from Ron about ports on the new MacBooks, specifically the MacBook Air, the MacBook, and the new MacBook Pro. His question is basically, you know, can I get all of my existing stuff, my printers, my drawing tablets, all these things that I have on USB, even my iPhones, can I hook those up to the new MacBooks and the MacBook Pros, the new ports? And it seems like a simple question, right? But outside of Nerdville, this really isn't all that simple because of the changing USB spec. You know, a lot of the new machines, the only port option is USB-C. And you would think, okay, well, that's USB. I have a USB printer. What's the problem? I can just, you know, hook these things up. But as you know, it's really not that straightforward. And I think it can be confusing to a number of users. Yeah, you and I might know, oh, well, all you need is a simple adapter. But it's not always that straightforward to everyone else. You know, changing a connection in an I/O standard can really be confusing. And so the short answer to you, Ron, is absolutely yes. I mean, you can hook all of your old stuff up to Apple's new machines, but depending upon which machine you choose and what connections it has available to you, that's where it can actually get tricky. So I want to, you know, back up a little bit and kind of go through each machine, talk about the connectors, talk about the technologies behind that, and then hopefully, you know, better explain and answer your question in a way that makes sense. So the MacBook and the new MacBook Pros have now standardized on the latest USB-C technology, USB-C. And with that, it brings a new type of USB connector. It seems like every time we get a new USB standard, it brings a new connector. And hopefully this is the last time that this happens. And I think that's where a lot of the confusion is coming into play for a lot of people. That and this latest version of the USB-C technology actually supports a number of different protocols outside and beyond USB-C, which is both good and bad depending upon, you know, what you're looking at. But with the latest USB-C technology is a new connector called the USB-C Type-C connector. And up until the USB Type-C connector, I'm going to have a hard time saying this, it's almost like a tongue twister, Macs really going all the way back to the original iMac used what was called the USB Type-A connector. Now, we had different variants of USB-C or USB over the years, starting with USB 1 and USB 2, USB 3, but throughout all of those different iterations of USB-C technology, we had the same connector, that flat, wide, you know, single direction USB connector that we're all familiar with, the one that's on the non-lightning end of your iPhone's lightning cable, right? USB, what most people think of when they think of a USB connector, that's USB type A. Now, there's also USB type B connectors. That's the fat square one that you probably have going into the back of your USB printer or your scanner. You also have the mini and micro versions of USB type B connectors, micro USB type B and mini USB type B. Those are most commonly found on your cameras and other small devices. That's the little mini connector. And there's been, again, two variants of that. So this all leads and adds to the confusion. Now, USB Type-C is great because it's now a new small connector, and it also has a similar advantage to, say, like the Lightning connector, where it's reversible. You can go either way. Prior to this, most USB connectors actually had a specific direction that you had to plug them in. Now, the different types of connectors within USB can support different versions of USB. And we're now currently at USB 3, but even there, it's not that straightforward. It gets confusing because we, you know, back in the day, it was simple. We had USB 1 and then USB 2 and then USB 3. But for some reason, after USB 3, they decided we're going to start just muddying the waters and making it a little bit more confusing because we're going to add little specs and enhancements on top depending upon the kind of hardware you have and the power ratings and stuff like that. So we ended up getting something called Super Speed USB, which was like USB 3.1. And then USB 3.1 Super Speed, which is now called apparently USB 3.1 Generation 1, was replaced with Super Speed Plus, USB 3.1 Generation 2. And depending upon which model machine you have and devices, you may support one and not the other. It's become this actual mess. And so now that we've moved on to USB-C, it's still USB 3, although a newer variant of it, I believe. I think we're up to still USB 3.1 Generation 2, and hopefully I'm not missing a version of USB 3 here. But USB-C really is mostly referring to the actual connector. Both the latest USB version 3 technology and the connector kind of came out at the same time, and most people just refer to all of it as USB-C. But the Type-C connector is the little connector that you're seeing Apple standardize on with the new MacBook and the new MacBook Pro. And what's great about it, like I said, is it can run a bunch of different input-output protocols. It also provides power. It's backwards compatible using adapters, as you'll hear in a moment. But you have a single connector that can do a number of different things. And so that's what's on the new machines. Now, the MacBook Airs still come from an era where we had different connectors, mostly for different I/O functions. So you have MagSafe for power. You have DisplayPort, which is also your Thunderbolt 2 port for your display and your high-speed input-output. You have an SD card slot. You have two USB 3 connections that use a USB Type-A connector, the traditional USB connector that most of us are familiar with. So if you care about having a bunch of different ports and different connectors and not having to use dongles and adapters or hubs or docks to connect your stuff, you probably would be more interested in a MacBook Air. Now, if you want the newest and latest and greatest, that's going to be the MacBook and the MacBook Pro systems. And there, your only connector option is going to be the USB Type-C. The advantage is you have just one type of connector to deal with, and that one connector can support almost any connection you need, provided that you have the proper adapter or cable. And so on the MacBook, and it is a little bit different depending upon what's supported, depending upon the model that you have, but on the MacBooks, the new MacBooks, the USB Type-C connector supports charging, USB 3.1 Generation 1, so not the latest generation of USB 3, DisplayPort 1.2, you can do VGA and HDMI if you have the right video adapters, and all of that is supported on the new MacBooks. When you bump up to the MacBook Pros, its Type-C connectors, USB Type-C connectors, support Thunderbolt 3, and that's going to be backward compatible to Thunderbolt 2. And depending upon which MacBook Pro model you choose, the 13-inch non-touch bar, which has two ports, the 13-inch touch bar, which has four ports, or the 15-inch model, which also has four ports, the speed of those ports may vary. On the 13-inch non-touch bar, the two-port model, and on the 15-inch four-port model, they all have full Thunderbolt 3, full PCI Express bandwidth ports. But on the 13-inch touch bar model, the one with four USB-C type ports, two of the ports, the ones on the right side, have a reduced PCI Express bandwidth. Probably not a big deal for a lot of people, but something you need to be aware of if you're going to buy that model and you're going to want to get the full Thunderbolt 3 throughput. You're going to want to connect those to the ports on the left-hand side. The MacBook Pros, the new ones, also have charging through the USB-C ports, and that's any port can do full charging, so it doesn't matter where you plug your charging cable into. They also do DisplayPort, VGA, HDMI for video, and support USB 3.1 Generation 2, so the latest and greatest version of USB 3.1. Of course, the downside, as many will point out, to our move to USB-C Type-C connectors is that many of your existing devices, if you're going to connect them, are going to require the purchase of either a new cable or a new adapter to connect to your Mac, or possibly a dock or some sort of hub. USB-C to Lightning cables are available for your iPhones and iPads. USB-C to other types of USB connectors, USB-A, USB, you know, mini USB, micro USB, those are all available. You can also get all kinds of little adapters. As a matter of fact, there's a company called Aki that makes these little USB adapters that you can stick on the end of all of your existing cables to basically turn them into USB-C type cables with USB-C type connectors. Another option is, and I think this is one of the best ones, is to get a USB-C dock, especially if you find that you use your notebook mostly as a desktop replacement. Here you can connect just a single USB-C cable that's going to carry all of your data I/O, your power, and everything into your machine. And then in the dock, you'll have all kinds of connection options depending upon which dock you choose for things like USB Type-A, Thunderbolt, DisplayPort, FireWire, Ethernet. All of these things are an option. Basically, they're very similar to our current generation Thunderbolt docks, and a lot of them come from the same places like OWC and CalDigit, and all of those folks are making great USB-C type docks. And also, if you get a new USB Type-C connector DisplayPort monitor, like the new LG UltraFine 4 or 5K displays that Apple worked with LG on developing, a lot of those actually have USB-C Type-C hubs built right into the display. So once again, you connect your display, that's actually going to provide all of your power, all of your data I/O, and then you just plug all of your hard drives and all your peripherals, your printers and everything into the USB-C ports on your monitor. Again, you're going to need adapters in or new cables in many of those cases, but once you buy all those things once, you're kind of done. And USB-C is really looking like it's going to be the future for a very long time. So right now in the short run, yeah, this is a little bit of a hassle. You're going to be spending some extra money that maybe you don't want to spend after dropping a bunch of money on a new MacBook Pro. But in the long run and, you know, over time, basically everything's going to be coming out with a USB-C connector. So your new cameras, your new printers, you know, they're all going to be supporting this new standard. And I think this new standard, because of the throughput and the technology itself, it's going to, the connector at least, the USB-C Type-C connector is going to be with us for a pretty long time. So I think we're not going to have to go through this again for a very long time. And if you think about how long we've lived with USB Type-A connectors, I would imagine it's going to be a similar run. And that's been a pretty long time. So hopefully this helps clear up any port confusion that you might have. And hopefully I did a good job explaining this. If I messed anything up or if I got something wrong, you guys are also always welcome to provide some feedback to me. Let me know where I went south, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS. You can check out all of their great applications. Get more information at smilesoftware.com/maccast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media, and they are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you're welcome to send me emails or audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you're on social media, you'd like to follow me between shows, send me any information or comments. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community. You'll find that at google.com/plus MacCast, and that's the plus symbol. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.